Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get it understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage. That's timeforanawakening.com, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and listen to the live stream from there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Well, awakening, that's in the black belt. And listen to the live stream at that location. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for Awakening Media. The home page is there. Full of new content, the different programs, their podcasts will be posted very soon, and other interesting articles and blogs to be coming shortly, all on the site. That should be one of your favorites. If it's not, make it one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're using an open forum, kind of Freestyle Friday, and we will get to that a little later on in the program. In the beginning of the program, we'll have some special guests joining us from the Black History Collaborative here in Philadelphia to talk about the initiative that they're doing with our young people here locally in the city. And we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215- 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, in spite of, and when I say in spite of, you know, being the cold ain't kosher.
Yeah, well, I got to agree with you. I got to agree with you today, Richard. It's cold out there.
Yeah, and it just dropped.
Yeah, the temperature's been dropping. Yeah, I know, because it wasn't this bad this morning.
Right.
Yeah,
but in spite of that, you know, things is you know, looking good. I'm glad that we were able to connect with the African American History Collaborative, because I'm just interested in the work and what they're doing in Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, you know, usually we have the kind of Freestyle Friday where some of the listeners can get in and just voice their opinions and things that happened during the week. And we'll probably get to that a little later on. But we're going to bring on one of our guests this evening, part of the Black History Collaborative. I think we have a Miss Kenya Ramey with us. Is this Miss Kenya?
Hello?
Yes, Kenya?
Oh, you can hear me? This is Stacy Enzinga Hill.
Okay.
I am also I'm one of the co-founders of the collaborative.
Okay, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing good.
How you doing, Stacy?
Good.
Well, Stacy, tell our listening audience a little bit about the collaborative, when it got started, and the mission of the Black History Collaborative.
Okay, Okay, so it's the Philadelphia Black History Collaborative,
mm-hmm.
and we're just a little over a year old, and we initially were comprised of all teachers. We were teachers, African-American history teachers at one point,
okay.
and we would get together and talk about, you know, Black history and what we were teaching, and through our conversations, we identified that there were some things that were missing in our instruction. And so we decided that we needed to write a curriculum that we will hopefully, that we hope will one day be implemented as a standard in the school system that will focus on 1968 to the present. So it's like a contemporary African-American history curriculum. So that's initially why we formed the group, because we wanted to write curriculum. But we also knew that in order to write that curriculum, it just couldn't come from our perspective. We needed the input of students, teachers, community activists, you know, just the entire community that has experienced, you know, what we've experienced here in the United States, particularly in Philadelphia as African-American people, or as African people here in America. So we started to reach out to people, you know, to kind of record their perspectives and, you know, encourage them to come contribute to building this curriculum. And we thought that one of the best ways to do that was to have a conference. And it wasn't a conference where we wanted to sit and just tell people what we thought and what we wanted to do and what we knew. We wanted to use it as a medium to bring people together, you know, to continue to build and kind of reclaim our narrative, you know, because as teachers in the school district and in the charter schools in Philadelphia and other places, it's just been an interesting ride, let me just say that. And we see a lot of gaps in students' learning, and we see a lack of connection that a lot of Black students have to themselves and their history. So we had our first conference last year, and it was very well received. It was at Kensington Kappa like it is this year. So during the course of between last year, February, and this year, we hosted quite a few book readings during the summer. We have monthly curriculum meetings where we still are working on building the curriculum. We've done a lot of outreach. We've, collaborated with other groups in the city just to try to further our mission. So that's pretty much who we are.
Stacy, you said that you guys have monthly meetings and things of that nature. And
yes.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of the classes, and correct me if I'm wrong, are held at one of the charter schools here in the city.
Well, the meetings, or what classes?
No. Okay, let's start with the meetings first. You said you have monthly meetings. Where are they held?
Yes, they are held at Philadelphia, at the Philadelphia Student Union in West Philly, on the corner of 52nd and Larchwood. So they are every, I believe, third Tuesday, from 5:30 to 7:30, and we build curriculum. We discuss topics. Sometimes we have homework where we do a little research to bring back to the table. We organize the information, you know, and because building curriculum, I think for a lot of people don't know how arduous it is. So it's a very arduous process, and it's slow moving, but that's what we're working on when we have those meetings every month. So it's at the Philadelphia Student Union on the corner of 52nd and Larchwood every third Tuesday of the month.
I was just there for a book read. I think the Sankofa study group. Mm-hmm. I want to say study group.
On Sundays.
Yes. And they were reading or finish up reading what this what's the name of that book? Elliot. This nonviolent stuff will get you killed.
Yeah, but Charles Kopp.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting. Why did y'all select 1968 to the present as far as the curriculum development?
Because what we would run into is that once we finished teaching the civil rights movement, it became, like a toss-up depending on the instructor of what was taught after that. Because there are narratives as to what the Black experience looked like from 68 to the present, but is not an agreed upon narrative. So, you know, there are some things that we've identified that seems to be, it's a lot of popular culture involved and a lot of focus on the Black middle class and the growth of the Black middle class and, you know, media and our images in the media and how we propel certain things in the media, but it was absent of politics. It was absent of the continued struggle from the civil rights movement. It was absent of the economic struggles and the economic advancements that we make. So we were like, okay, this is it needs to be comprehensive, because we saw some very scary things going on in some of the classrooms across the city in terms of African-American history, because people were creating their own narrative, and it wasn't necessarily accurate, and it wasn't necessarily from our perspective. So we were like, we need to standardize this, and that's why we chose 68 to the present.
And 68 is when the students in Philadelphia was the walkout, or created the walkout in relation to getting African-American history within the school.
Mm-hmm. It was actually mandated, I believe, in 2005. But the history of it becoming mandated goes back to the walkout. So yeah, it was a direct, I guess, product of the walkout. Absolutely.
I hear. I was involved in LA. You know, help me out anytime. But I was involved in a charter school, and I was also involved in seeing a curriculum as a non-educator, seeing the formation, since we were dealing with an African-centered school, trying to formalize a curriculum. So I understand the difficulty that is. But I wanted to kind of to back up, if we may, because, you know, in the 68 walkout at that time, it was about African-American, the total realm of African-American history being instituted, creating a curriculum and being instituted in a public school system. So my question is, do the educators today see a different climate in relationship to putting in this political machinery called the educational institution, even proposing a curriculum for African-Americans, telling African-American history, even if it's just from 68 to the present?
So what exactly was the question again?
Is there a different climate? You know, when they did the walkout, it was about, one of the elements was about having African-American history in the public school system, right?
So let's be clear. I was not born at that time. So I don't know exactly what the climate is. I wasn't there. I know, you know, historically, but I believe it is. I believe there's, for one, students are less politicized now across the board, across race, across ages, across, you know, geographic boundaries. They're less politicized. And the students then were very political. I mean, they had to be. First of all, that was the climate of the day. But they had to be to organize and initiate something like that. So that's a huge difference. The fact that it's mandated now, but there are no checks in place to ensure that those who are teaching it are, for lack of a better word, qualified, right? That has something to do with the lack of politicization. Help me out.
Politicalization. You're right.
There you go. Politicalization of students today as well. Yeah, the climate is different. Inside the schools, outside the schools, it's totally different. There are, for one, there are fewer black teachers in the schools now, especially in black communities. Community schools don't exist in the way that they did historically, in especially major cities. Teachers are less political, and those who are, I believe, have a specific agenda that's not consistent with what our agenda should be or is. Yeah, it's a totally different climate. And even the students don't necessarily see a necessity to have something like this. All they know is they have to take it. They have to take it. So it's definitely a struggle, just being in the classroom and then also participating in this type of initiative. It's a struggle. Yeah.
And the reason why I bring that up, and I think that your point, I agree with your perspective in relationship to the what's the political climate in relationship to education? But the reason I bring it up, because, you know, the fight to get that in, and I remember in Philadelphia, as in other cities, there were from state legislators push for African-Americans to standardize a curriculum, to have teachers present that curriculum. And it seemed to have been a pushback by the teaching community, who were in most cases, especially in urban areas, was predominantly white, to actually deliver it. To where in Philadelphia, I think with Dr. Ed Robinson and them developed that curriculum that they had, and I understand that you're having Dana King as speak at this conference. So with the so she's quite aware of the curriculum that was developed, and it wound up in the basement of
the
closet.
In the closet, yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, for the listening audience in general, do they have the same experience that Philadelphia is having? But I've seen in Pennsylvania, in Seattle, and especially amongst the charter schools who were trying to specifically, that there was a pushback by the political machinery to not emphasize. So do we need that in order to support what you're doing?
Yeah, and do we need the machine?
Yeah, we need our politicalization as African Americans.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because one of the reasons why we're reaching out to, I guess, as they call now, the stakeholders in education, is that if it's not what they want, then there's really no point in doing it. If it's not what the parents want, if it's not what the students want, if it's not what the teachers want, if it's not what the principals want, then there's no point in doing it because it won't be received well. And then they won't be reflected in it because they didn't contribute to it. It's not of them. So you have to be politicized to understand the necessity of it. And that's why we realize we can't just write a curriculum. We have to do teach-ins. We have to hold meetings. We have to recruit. We have to teach parents about how they should have input in terms of what their students are learning. We need to teach students that they should have input in terms of what they're learning. So the whole, it's not necessarily just a climate, but it's also what people believe the purpose of education is. It has to be reimagined because it's bleak right now, in my opinion. It's bleak. And, you know, but there are people that are definitely, you know, once you turn them on to it, it's like, oh, we do need that. My child isn't learning this, or they were told this by the teacher. You know what I'm saying? So I think people need to understand it's not enough just to be a bystander and see these things happening sometimes to your own children, is that you have to be politicized and you have to be an agent in your own fate. And, we're trying to offer an avenue for people to do that.
Stacey, you talked about the the need to establish some type of curriculum because you've seen some scary things going on at other, and I guess we'll get to some of those things because I want you to kind of maybe voice some things if you feel free to do so for our listening audience to get a grasp. But Richard mentioned Ed Robinson for one, and I know that if I'm not mistaken, I'm more than sure that Malefi Asante had wrote a curriculum also for the schools,
textbook, everything.
Yeah. Do you think it's important because you started from 68, and I think for a reason, because the students had the things that Richard was speaking of earlier when they started to protest and walked out. But do you think it's important to establish to the young people and to some adults that don't think it's necessary that the origins of our people didn't necessarily come from here and slavery and 1968? I mean, we've been on this earth thousands of years and had civilizations long before Europeans knew anything about the word. I think a lot of our people established their narrative and you correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of our people establish our narrative based on a European narrative of government here in the United States. Everything mm-hmm. is centered around what Europeans have established here instead mm-hmm. of centered around the proud traditions of our ancestors and what they established, their political framework, mm-hmm. their philosophies. A lot of mm-hmm. our people don't know about them. So you can't mm-hmm. really move forward as a people until you know about these things. Give me your opinion on some of that.
No, I agree. And the reason we're starting in 68 not as a start to the school year
okay.
for that course. It's a supplement to the course and we've also talked about, because in order to build this curriculum from 68, we had to take a look at what it would look like before 68, because that would lay a groundwork for students to be able to understand the things that we wanted to teach or to be taught in the curriculum that we're developing. And it's absolutely necessary to understand that our history did not start as slaves here in this country. Even who we are now, much of it, that retention that we have is African retention, is African culture. And it's very necessary, because I see what I see children doing now is they are embracing someone else's fundamental culture, not mm-hmm. being able to identify or determine what is actually theirs and what is someone else's. And so that means that if you embrace someone else's culture and become that, then you are not being actually who you are. It's counterintuitive. It's counterproductive. You know, so absolutely, absolutely. You need to know those things. And so, I mean, that just shows that the entire curriculum needs to be restructured, right? It all needs to be restructured. But that's too big of a piece for us to take on. You know what I'm saying? We're starting small, but it needs to be restructured to reflect the honest truth about who we are and where we came from.
One of the things that we touched on, and it has to be elaborated when we're talking about this trying to in a public school system, and that's the public school system anywhere, is to really understand the politics of the community that has to be involved for people like yourself who are taking on this task of creating a curriculum. Therefore, we have to, not just educate parents, but the whole community have to be educated to this whole understanding of that. I just ran across, and I seen this Atlantic article where it says, and if y'all can bear with me for a couple of paragraphs, why kids are really learning about slavery. What kids are really learning about slavery? And this is a report released by the Southern Poverty Law Center, Teaching Tolerance Project, points to widespread failure to actively teach the hard and nuanced history of American slavery and enslaved people. And then it goes on and said the cohort that it actually, and this reemphasizes what you had said, Stacey, and what it describes as the first analysis of its kind. Teaching Tolerance conducted online surveys of 1,000 American high school seniors and more than 1,700 social study teachers across the country. The group also reviewed 10 commonly used U.S. history textbooks and examined 15 sets of state standards to assess what students know, what educators teach, what publishers include, and what standard required vis-a-vis slavery. Among 12th graders, only 8% could identify slavery as the cause of the Civil War. Fewer than one-third, 32%, correctly named the 13th Amendment as the formal end of slavery, and a slightly higher, 35%, choosing the Emancipation Proclamation. I'll stop there on that, but it does speak to what you were saying, not necessarily a lack of understanding of just in that period of slavery, but a lack of understanding the importance of history and how effective it is actually being administered. And I'm always looking at it from the community itself, right? Because if we do 68, the community was educating and basically organizing the students to do the walkout at that point in time. It was a continuity or an intergenerational piece, where now the politics of education we don't really have, the politics of advocating education. So I kind of commend what y'all are doing, and I'm just trying to see how do we take this and move it to re-educate as a political education of the community in general, with these numbers saying that the community don't, their parents, their grandparents are not actually pushing this forward. Therefore, our politics is not pushing it forward, right?
Right, right. I wonder, did politics ever push it forward? You know, I think that, just like you said, the movement came from the community, right? Mm-hmm. It was the community that pushed the students to do it. So we can't necessarily rely. I don't think it would be a successful thing if it's a top-down type of situation. So it's just basically we have to politicize the community. And that's why we want to go out. That's why we have been going out and trying to bring people in, because we know we can't do it without them. We just can't. But we also know it's a necessity. It's a necessary thing that has to happen. So, yeah.
I was wondering how is it shaping, if it's possible to project now, how is this narrative shaping in relationship to the community? And I'm interested in the narrative, the perspective. As y'all are meeting, since y'all are meeting and you're pulling this together, how do you, the group that's doing this, how is this narrative flushing itself out?
That's a good word. It's flushing itself out. I think our biggest population, you know, when we are able to reach the most number of people at one time at these conferences. And so, it's been slow. It's been slow because there's so many initiatives now that are pulling us in so many directions, you know, in terms of what we think we should be doing politically. We're actually competing, you know, with other initiatives. So it's been it's a very young organization, mm-hmm. but I think that we've enjoyed some success in just alerting people to the fact that we're out there, we're out here, and what we're doing. You know, and it's going to take some time to, like, perspective and understand, you know, how important education is. Okay. How important education is in terms of our development and our trajectory in life, you know?
Well, how do you see this? Now we just transitioned in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania for Philadelphia to have a city-appointed school board compared to the state?
Appointed school board, right, and then eventually an elected school board.
How do you see, and I'm just asking your opinion, that flushing out as far as those members that will become a part of that, taking on this initiative, as do you see, are you hopeful?
Again, it'll only be successful if we become politicized, organized, and focused, right? So, and understand, you know, what really, truly the purpose of education needs to be for us, right? We can't continue to take on this idea that the same thing education is supposed to do for white people is what it's going to do for us. Or we can use it in the same way. Or our trajectory needs to be the same. We have to look at ourselves once again as an isolated community, because that's what we are, right? With different needs, a different history, a different future, because we have a different past, we have a different culture and all these different things. So I think that now is and because this is becoming such a diverse world, I guess, and that's like what people are focusing on, and we're being absorbed in this, and we're starting to lose our identity and, you know, kind of blend into everything else. We have to reclaim who we are, and we have to be proud of that, and we need to use that in our politics. And we need to use that in determining where we go from here.
Stacey, the You mentioned that you don't, and correct me if I'm wrong, that when you started talking about the African American History Collaborative here, that some of these things might not be achieved under the school system now as it's constituted, that the need for community schools. Now, I'm kind of adding this. I think it's a need for community schools to be reinstituted, if they were ever instituted here in Philadelphia. Me personally, I think that because we have two or three of them sometimes in the block, that churches, temples, and mosques are to be utilized to re-educate our children, educate and re-educate our children. They shouldn't be used on Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays as just worshiping places where people feel good and hoop and holler and praise the Lord. It's a place for that. But if we see that our generations of our children are in trouble, and we have to do something to change this paradigm. So these places need to be used to re-educate our children. Give me your opinion on that.
I agree. I mean, they need to be community centers. They don't need to have just one purpose. They need to be community centers. And because I mean, with the closing of public schools and opening of charter schools and selective enrollment, schools used to be those community centers. They weren't always as successful as we wanted them to be, but they were like the center of the community. And when we were forced to go, to our neighborhood schools, at least we knew the people who were there. We knew the parents. So there was a shared interest. There was a shared, future, you know. And so now we're fragmented. Your child goes to school halfway across the city. You don't know the PTA means that there is a PTA. They have all their extracurricular activities somewhere else and not in the neighborhood. We need to look at the fact that we're now fragmented and separated, and that's having a very detrimental effect on our community. So now those institutions that used to help hold us together, like the mosques, the churches, if there is a community center or whatever, really need to step up their game, right? And start to reiterate the importance of their existence, right? So, yeah, I mean, you're right. You're right. We're some of the things that we had before, I think we took for granted and we didn't understand the importance of them, and now we're suffering because of it. And our children don't even know that reality. So they don't even know to ask for it. They don't even know to, you know, to fight for it because they never had it.
Okay.
So we all need to step up our game, I think. We all need to. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do as educators. You know, we feel a sense of responsibility, and this is the best way we see how to do it.
Let me take a call here. Let's go to 602. 602, area code.
Yes, brother Richard and brother Elliot and brother and the sister, the lion.
How are you, Marcus? Sir? How are you?
I'm doing all right. You know, in the early 1990s, I lived in New York, and we had the same issue. We were trying to implement. They had curriculum of inclusion. They tried to get, you know, African-centered curriculum into the New York City school system. Now, the chancellor at that time was a brother, was a black chancellor, I think it was Richard Green. He was very, very much for that curriculum. Mysteriously, one morning, he dropped dead. He heard, oh, the chancellor had a heart attack, and he dropped dead. And that was the end of that. Okay? Now, these people here have no intention of us incorporating a curriculum into their curriculum, because their curriculum is designed to mislead our people, give them a false sense of reality. That is their job. That is the purpose of the educational system. That is the purpose of the religious institution. You see, that's why they are not working in our interest. They are working in the interest of the system. So we have to find other ways to get this information out to our people instead of trying to use the public school system, because they are not going to do it. You see, it's like you have in a glass of, it's like you have a glass full of cyanide. And you pour out half the cyanide, and you fill up the glass with juices and minerals and vitamins. But what you have, you still have poison. You see?
Yeah.
So we need a curriculum of exclusion to exclude all them lies that they have been, you know, teaching our people. But it's a very noble approach. It's a very, you know, but we have to devise a way to how we can get this information to our people without the help of the church, because they ain't going to help. I'm telling you. I am speaking from experience. Okay? I went to one of the church, one of the very prominent churches in Harlem with a program. And you know what the reverend told us? He said, look, our job is to save souls. See? That's what he said. In spite of all these things, he said, look, brother, our job is to save souls. So, you know, but we have the information. So we just have to find our way to get it out, you know, whether it's whatever, you know, we get the information out to our people, you know, in spite of the roadblocks they're going to put up.
Right.
They're going to put up roadblocks. Anyway, she's
there. One of the things that I forgot to mention is that our mission is pretty long, so I don't want to read it, but it's based in Black liberation, period. So it's a liberatory curriculum in a sense where it's not just a dissemination of information. It is useful information in order for us to free ourselves, period. Period. Because it looks like after 68, like we just assimilated. And that's what it looks like. You know what I'm saying? If you go to, there are African-American history books and, you know, textbooks. And some of them, they push the narrative that it was all about assimilation. It was all about integrating ourselves into American society, when in fact that is not what it was, right? The suffering continued, the disenfranchisement continued, the outright attacks on our existence, the genocide continued, economic genocide, the physical genocide, all of these different things. And so in building this curriculum, first of all, we connect it to the civil rights struggle in terms of a continuum, but we also identify, like, look, these are the things that you need to know and be able to analyze and look at these things so you will, number one, not make these mistakes again, number two, see how America has treated us and how it's been consistently treating us and how it hasn't changed, in order to say, hey, look, we need to be focused on how to be free at this point. So that's the foundation of, you know, what we're building. It's not just a, you know, a whole bunch of facts and some names and you got to memorize this and, you know, some feel good stuff in there. You know what I'm saying? It's going to make you feel good because you're going to feel like you want to be free. So that's what we're trying to do. And I understand that that's probably not going to get a stamp of approval, but we're going to push it anyway. Because I think in the process of pushing it, you politicize people and you get that information out. Right, to the point where they say, hey, this is what we want, and
we're going to
get it one way or the other.
Yeah, you're correct, because, you see, what they do in this educational system is they give us a history from our low point. You see, our history is taught to us from a low point here in the United States. They don't go past 1619. You see, so your history begins here in America. In 1619, so what was happening before 1619? What was black people? That is not taught in American history.
Right, and that was the point that was made earlier.
Yes. So it's beautiful what you're doing, and as I said, that information is needed worldwide. It's not just here. We need to translate it in Spanish, English, French, Portuguese, and disseminate it all across the planet. Anyway, thank you so much. I'll continue listening.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Have a
good night. You know, Sister Stacy and Brother Elliot, the reason why I heard about the Philadelphia Black History Collaborative, I think it was at the African Liberation Day. I think it was Brother Ishmael Demaz.
Uh-huh.
He was speaking one of the one of the speakers, and it struck me because the whole what I took away with of that was the ideal of us creating our narrative, and I'm a believer in the importance of that for the reasons that a brother just called it and just had said, but I also think, and as we're having this discussion about it, it's so important to recognize that how much is important that be organizers, people taking the initiative. And if y'all don't mind, I just want to give the example, a personal example, because I'm gonna let y'all know I'm always self-centered, right? So as Elliot said, I'm a volunteer at the African American Museum, and recognized that it was important to have the museum outreach into the community because it's a cultural public institution, and it's not getting Native Africans, Philadelphians to the museum as much as we should, based off of that same history. That was 76, but the evolution of that 1976, the museum came into being was because of what happened in 60, 67, 68.
Oh.
Right? The evolution of that institution being there. So we just worked out, the docents, the volunteers, just worked out with the public library. The public library is another resource that we as organizers should be able to utilize because it's an information center within the community. And we worked out a relationship with the regional librarian in West Philadelphia, where I believe, as you said, matter of fact, it's right down the street, a couple of blocks from Sampson to Larchwood. The reason why I'm bringing this up, and hopefully the listening audience understand, is that it requires, because politics, is integration of us negotiating and creating programs, not just being a part of the political system, Democrat, Republican. First, if we don't do it. So we was able to do that, and I see that the Philadelphia Black History Collaborative also could be working together, because what's at the library? Books. What happens that's where the reading is, right? That's where students have to go. People in the community do go and utilize that resource. So I'm looking at, from an organizing perspective and helping the formation of this curriculum, that possibly the people who volunteer at the museum, the people who work at the library, and people like yourselves who are part of the collaborative can work together to help politicize or organize or assist in developing this kind of curriculum. And I'm saying that hopefully as a model and example to the listening audience, where it may be done already, which they should call in and let us know, or could do, because the work that y'all are doing, y'all taking that initiative, the work we're doing, we're taking the initiative. But the question is, why are we not as politicized as it was 1968?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, though, I'm sitting outside of the museum now. I just left their Black Pulp exhibit, which is wonderful. I definitely need to get my students on that. But all this summer, we had a book reading. We read the book We Are an African People by Russell Rickford, which chronicled the evolution of African-centered independent education here in the United States. And it started with Ocean Hill, Ocean Hill, Brown, I forgot, in New York, it was on the back of maybe a decade or so after the Brown verdict, and how they were struggling with the integrating of the public schools in these Black communities, and how they kind of initiated this community control of their schools. And then there was a more radical approach and said, hey, let's just back off this altogether and just create our own schools with our own curriculums. And they evolved into what was the African Centered Independent School Movement, where some are still around today as charter schools or as independent schools or part of CB, which is the Council of Independent Black Institutions. So, yeah, we were there all the summer. Like, I think it was for about 6 or 8 weeks at the library in West Philly on 52nd. That's when we were holding our book reading.
And that's why it's so important, you know, to show what we try to do in this program, to show how Elliot lets us know all the time that the work that's being done, because a lot of that work is not being seen. And though it may seem like separate, it is connected to curriculum development, right? So, and the dialogue we need to have to move our community forward, to bring this historical perspective back centered to this generation and folk and others that's coming online.
Yeah.
Stacey, let me ask you a question. In fact, how's your time? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. In this age now that our young people are coming up in, reading is not paramount among some circles of our young people. In fact, the way public schools kind of push students along, I have family members that have graduated school recently and can't read. And and if they can read, they can't comprehend. I remember when I was going to school, you had reading classes and you had reading comprehension where you could understand what you're reading. So in the age now where a lot of young people or a segment of young people are doing things visually, looking at the movies or things of that nature, how is that infused into helping them historically? You know, where you would use maybe African-centered documentaries, films, things of that nature, so they can visually see certain things and maybe talk about it from that perspective. Is that infused in? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What we say is that.
I'm saying, is that going to be infused, or is that being infused into some of the collaborative's efforts?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. We all know the value in using. I was showing my students Eyes on the Prize today. For the last 3 days, we've been watching the different episodes. And it's almost a necessity now because of the lack of comprehension that students display in their reading.
Yes.
You know, they can recall, regurgitate, but after that, they're not reading on their own. They're not reading for leisure. And they're not reading viable information that speaks to them developing as a productive citizen, as a historical being, as a cultural being. It's just not there. So it's almost a necessity to bring in those types of tools. And we are definitely integrating that into the curriculum. I mean, we have lists. We compile lists of resources from books to excerpts to primary sources to documentaries to movies to, you know, to historical fiction to audio to narratives, tape recording people who were actually there. And, you know, so yes, it's all these different types of media because we have different modalities in learning. And the point is that we have to hit everybody where they are. You know, they have to understand this information. They have to be able to analyze it, comprehend it. I mean, ultimately, you've got to know how to read it and understand what you read. I mean, that's the bottom line. But a lot of these things work as bait, you know, and support or reinforcement for what you may have read. They have to develop a love for reading. They have to develop a thirst for that knowledge. They just have to.
Okay.
So these are, you know, these are the things that we're using to help to develop that and also relay information in a different medium. But we definitely have those things as part of the curriculum, as far as resources in the curriculum.
Uh-oh, Sister Stacey, I think I'm getting ready to put you on the spot, and as a professional, as an educator, but I want to talk to you as a member of the Philadelphia Black community, right?
Okay.
Because a lot of times we know that a large portion of the teaching profession that our students are in front of, you just mentioned that you use the Eyes on the Prize, and you had mentioned earlier about what you've seen and what y'all have seen as educators that are going on in these classrooms that is just inappropriate. So it makes me wonder about these teachers. Would you say this is because it don't seem like they have a reading comprehension challenge. It don't seem like they have, they being in the profession, that they have a research challenge. So I guess I'm asking, what is your opinion on why it seems to be so difficult for especially the majority community, who seems to be the majority of the teaching black children, and I'm being more specific, white teachers, white female teachers, who are teaching black children, what's the challenge where they can, as a personal initiative, pick up a video, a book, and present in whatever way, as you're doing, in creative ways, this information to our children in sitting in those seats?
I think that we all gravitate towards what we know, what we want to know, what's reflective of us. I just had a very honest conversation with a colleague. He's a white colleague. He's a history teacher who teaches African-American history. And he honestly was just like, I am not familiar with this material. I am not. He was like, why aren't you teaching it? You know? And I'm like, I don't know, because I teach world history. And he was like, that was a positive experience for me because it was very honest, right? And even though he didn't say it, there was some acknowledgement of how this information can be best relayed to children, right? Now, on the flip side, I think in order to answer your question, I think we have to understand this very fundamental shift in the education system and why there is this shift. Now, I guess I'm going to get, if I need to explain further, because I'm going to get a little bit technical on the technical side of education. There is a way that we're encouraged to teach now. It is not holistic. It is extremely fragmented. It's extremely slowed down. There's not an, although they talk about they want students to learn how to critically think, there is no emphasis on critical thinking. There is none. There's no emphasis on application. There are huge gaps in students' learning, right? So, but many of these young teachers, this reform started in like the early 90s. Many of these young teachers are a product of that reform, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then there is this depoliticizing of our society, where you don't have to go outside of what you know and what you want to know and who you are in order to teach. Because there's also this idea of this urban education approach that these children, these urban children, are others, right? They are not of you. This is who they are. So you must come in and approach them as others, but you are the expert. You are the one that knows, right, everything. So there is no real push for you to have to become the learner and the student is the teacher. It's not a real exchange, right? So you spoke about the overflow of young white female teachers in the schools. The effect of that is that they don't pick up these documentaries because they know nothing about them. This was not part of their education. It wasn't part of their education. It wasn't part of their training. And it wasn't a part of their training in terms of they weren't exposed to it, nor were they trained and told that it was necessary for them to learn it to be an effective teacher of these children. The most you have to do, you have to go through this cultural sensitivity, whatever, which I don't even know what that is because it's not historically sound. It's not put in a historical context. So now you have a system where you have people coming in to save us from ourselves because we just could not teach our own children, right? With this concocted idea of we were all failing, right? But, so this is why they don't pick it up. Because they're not supposed to. They don't need to. Why should they? Why should they? They determine what is relevant and what is necessary for our children to learn inside the classrooms, inside these universities, inside of these teacher training institutes. They decide with no historical reference. Last year at the conference, I had a workshop. Dana King was on the panel. A brother, Baye Kimmett, who's now the national spokesperson for CB, Isaiah Thomas, a couple of other people. Now, if you all know Dana King, right?
Yes.
Right. So you know she ran through the history.
Right.
She took it all the way back of black education in the United States. Baye Kimmett ran through the CB schools and the independent black institutions. Most of the people in that room knew nothing of this. The white teachers in that room, they said, I knew nothing of this. How do you not know this, but you teach majority black children? How do you not seek this out in order to do your best to develop these children's cultural selves? Because that is not what you're there for. That's not why you're there. You're there to push an agenda. You're there to push a culture. You're there to push something that is not conducive to the spiritual, cultural, and intellectual growth of these children. It's just not. It's just not. So that's why they're not going to turn on Eyes on the Prize. You know what I'm saying?
And it's interesting.
They're not going to do it.
It goes to what Brother Marcus was saying, as far as, I mean, what you and I've seen this in having to sit and interview teachers where, you know, who have taught in majority what they call urban settings, but when you ask them what was their exposure to African American history, they didn't have any. But let me flip it on you just for your opinion. So what about the African American? You said since 1990, this whole training and teacher development. Would you say the African American teachers, those young teachers that are coming out, still also have?
Same training. And some of them have been politicized in white organizations, right? So inadvertently pushing the same agenda.
Mm.
I mean, this is the thing where culture comes into play. It really doesn't matter what race you are. If you adopt cultural norms and cultural behaviors, right, you are, as a black person, if you adopt European cultural norms and cultural behaviors, and that's what you push, that's what you teach, that's who you are. You are betraying the very person who you are. It doesn't matter what your skin tone looks like. You are pushing an other culture, right? So that's what's happening. I had this conversation today with another member of the collaborative, and we always talk about how important culture is. But a lot of people see culture as our manifestations, right? How you dance, what you eat, what you wear. Not understanding that it's your value system, it's your worldview, it's your respectability. It's all of these things. It's how you socialize with other people. It's how you value human life. It's what you will do and what you won't do and what guides those principles. And people aren't understanding that, right? So, and like these teachers that come in, when they think of black culture, African garb, maybe. It's actually urban culture, hip-hop, graffiti, rap, popular culture. You know, so they haven't done their homework because they don't respect us enough to do the homework.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Sister Stacy of the African American History Collaborative here in Philadelphia. Stacy, again, what's your last name? It escaped me.
Hill, H-I-L-L.
Good. And you can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
You all are really to be admired, and I want you to know that you have my moral support. I'm going to be praying for you. I'm going to be coming back to see you, and we are going to be demanding, when we go to Washington, that something be done, and done immediately, about these conditions. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today, many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And again, we usually have a little kind of Freestyle Friday format, and we'll probably get to that a little bit later on. We have a special guest joining us in conversation, Ms. Stacy Hill of the African American History Collaborative here in Philadelphia, dealing with our young people in public schools and exposing them to the historical narrative that will hopefully change, not hopefully, that will change the mindset of our people moving forward. Stacy, you still there?
Yes.
Listen, I want to ask you a question, and I played those clips, and there's a lot of others. I played those clips for a reason, because you mentioned earlier, and one of the mission statements or mission of the African American History Collaborative is controlling the narrative.
Yes.
Now, we just passed Martin Luther King's celebration of his birthday in January 15th. And you hear the same thing rolled out there all the time. And there's other people controlling the narrative. He was a dreamer. They played a dream speech over and over to the point where black people just parrot these things. Now, what I want to do is tie it in with what you talked about earlier about critical thinking and controlling the narrative. Now, Dr. King himself critically analyzed what he was doing. And in the last 2 years of his life, he started voicing those things and changing the narrative. But when we talk about King, we parrot other people's narratives of King. Oh, he's a dreamer. I have a dream. A little black men, I mean, little white boys and white girls, and the same thing. And then our people get up here, and some elected officials, and keep on parroting this narrative. So you're not teaching our young people to critically look at this man's life and see where the last 2 years of his life probably led to why he was assassinated. They don't critically look at everything. They just stuck to deal with 1963 and a speech that he made in Washington. And I just threw that out there to get your opinion based on some of the things about the controlling the narrative. How do you see that? And not necessarily that, but just in a whole of having other people control the narrative of some of our ancestors.
Oh, wow. And it's interesting that you should say that, because I just spoke to them today about his I Have a Dream speech, and in part of my lesson, because we usually hear the last half, not the first half. So we talked about, because I teach world history, and we were talking about Martin Luther and the Reformation and things like that. So I tied it into reform. But I also, I pulled out where he talked about a promissory note and cashing a check. And I said a lot of people thought he was not confrontational, but he was extremely confrontational in a peaceful way, in a nonviolent way. Let me say in a nonviolent way. But in the speech, he talked about how he would not rest. We would not rest until we were given what we were promised, period, right? And so I had to explain to them, that's what all the protests were. It was a constant wearing down until you got what you want. So I talked just about that, the narrative, and how that part you usually don't hear, because it does not fit the narrative that has been put forth about him. But we've had a dialogue within the collaborative about how we push forth other people's narrative, specifically Martin Luther King. Now, there was some current analysis about the civil rights movement, and we talked about how some narratives talk about how because Bayard Rustin was a homosexual, he was isolated from the civil rights movement and its leadership, and which is an untruth. Some people want to, even during the Martin Luther King Jr. celebration, or service, right? When the days of service, that he was somehow some type of misogynistic person that alienated women from the movement and did not celebrate them. No, we have been written out by somebody else's narrative. So there's, even as adults, right, because we get so influenced by other people's perspectives, because we never develop one of our own, and we don't think critically, we just accept that as we're told, and we push it forward. And that's a very dangerous thing, because some people have no bones about rewriting history and then eliminating the truth from your grasp, right? And it's just dangerous because it becomes a generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, you talk to somebody a couple of generations from you, and they're telling you a whole different story about something that you know the truth about, but this is what they believe to be true because it was what was told and taught to them. But then again, that speaks again to what is necessary and fundamental in our education. We have to determine what is necessary for our children to learn. Because we have to have an agenda as to why they're learning it. Right now, they're just there, right? And probably to be workers and, you know, and because we live in a society where, you know, you go to school, you get a job, you got to get yours. And you know what I'm saying? That is somebody else's culture. That is somebody else's agenda. That's somebody else's trajectory. We have to determine why we had this education and what we're supposed to use it for and what our future is going to look like. And we're not having those conversations. We're not making those determinations. So, but these are the conversations that we have in our curriculum group. This is the conversations that we have in our steering committee. These are the conversations that we have at the conferences because we have to determine what our future is going to look like collectively as a people, as an African people, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, I agree with you.
And Sister Stacy, because what I'm curious about is how to do in presenting that portion that you did, and over the time that you've been in dealing with this in your class, how did the students respond? I mean, can you give us a sampling of was there resistance? Was there partial excitement? What was the how was that interactive of presenting this narrative and in a historical context? As a teacher, how have students been responding to it?
How did they react? Let's be clear, it was not interactive. It was not. There were a lot of stares, you know what I'm saying? And I just hope and cross my fingers that it's stinging in, that just looks like deep thought. That's just all of them. They were quiet, and they listened as they usually do. Now, in terms of conversation, it's like, please give me something, you know, but I don't know. I'm still working on them dialoguing because they're good students, they're good children, but they, in terms of, I don't think that they know that their opinion is valuable, what they think is valuable, because they don't voluntarily offer it. They don't.
Yeah.
They don't. And I think that's a very sad thing because they're not empowered.
I would like to expand that, you know, when we talk about education, how this really doesn't happen in the public school system. It really happens in our families and community, right? And
right.
When we talk about our culture, and I think that this is something that we need to kind of acknowledge or at least admit to, and it might be my perception, that we have a demand-directed culture now. It doesn't really hold itself to dialogue or diversity of opinion even within our family. Do this, do that, come here, go there.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't allow young people to be a part of a interactive, and when they do, it's, you know, depending on how they do it, it's almost dangerous.
Yeah, it's not an explain yourself. Even that would do some good. Explain your behavior. You know, not just don't do that anymore. Why did you do that?
Mm.
Why did you do that? So yeah, it's they're not. I hate it, but I think that's what it is. They just don't think that their opinion is valuable, that their thoughts are worth discussing in that type of setting. You know, and I just got to keep working on it. I just got to keep working on it.
We all
because they are. Yeah, they are. They are valuable. They have to be told that they're valuable. But I teach high school, so I see them for a year. Who knows what their other teachers will be telling them? And that's one of the most important things beyond just of course it's important to know how to read and, you know, critically think, but you have to critically question too. You have to be able to say, like, when you are sitting in front of that teacher and they are passive-aggressive in their attack of you. You have to, and you know it. You might not be able to completely identify specifically how it's done, or, but you know it. That you have the right to question that, right? You have the right to say, hey, I feel like this, and call them on it. And that's, I think that's the biggest gift that I could ever give to my students. When you leave here, you ask questions. And you tell people if you feel like your very being, right, everything you are is under attack. You open your mouth and you say that. And it's not happening. To empower our children is not part of the educational agenda anymore. It is not.
To empower ourselves.
Yeah, I don't think it ever really was. Yeah, let's go to.
But when you have black teachers when you have black teachers from the neighborhood, where they looked at these children and saw their children and saw themselves, it was automatic.
Because you didn't
want your power taken away from you, so you don't want their power taken away from them. So it was automatic. Now, different.
Let's go to 646.
Hey, what's going on, Richard and Elliot? And good evening to your guests. Very good program. Enjoying it. Basically, my question is, you know, y'all put together these programs to give information to the kids, but it's information that the administration don't want the kids to have. So why don't, and this is all around the country, I'm basically saying this, why don't teachers take that information out to the community and get these pork chop chicken eating preachers to open up their churches so that we could start educating our kids like that you do and other cultures do? Because, you know, in all honesty, the public school system is nothing but a place to identify who will be a good Negro peen as they age. That's all it is. They'll identify those that will be willing to work within the system for their best interest, and those that they deem not to be, you know, they'll be cast aside or placed back into slavery, a.k.a. the prisons.
Gotcha. I can't hear you.
Hello? No, that was a question, Jay.
No, can I hear you a little better now. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Jay, go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, Jay's question was you were saying in as far as why the teachers taking their power to direct it towards the administration, or
in general, the administration, I'm clear, is never going to go along with anything that's African or any perspective of an honest analysis of history. They're not going to never go along with that. History proves it. My whole thing is, why aren't, you know, our organization able to take this to the community?
Oh, what happened to Jay?
Yeah, we just lost him. Jay, give us a call back. That's 646. Jay, give us a call right back, and we'll get you right back on. Let me see if he'll call us right back. But, Stacey, did you get the gist of Jay's question when he was yeah, he's back. Jay?
Yeah. Sorry about that.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But no, I'm basically, my whole thing is, you know, we know the administration is not going to go along with this. My question is, why hasn't her organizations, or have they been able to go to these pork chop chicken eating preachers and get them to open up their churches on Saturday or one day during the week after school so we could start giving this information and basically educating our children to a better situation? Because it's never going to happen in public school, like I said earlier. They're just there to identify those that will be good Negro peens, as far as I'm concerned. And the rest will be cast aside and put in jail, which is the new slavery, or the continuous slavery.
Yeah.
I think, again, our best bet is to reach out to the community. Because if they demand it, you know what I'm saying, then the preachers will open their doors because they're the congregation, right? And so the preachers will open their doors, the mosques will open their doors, but it has to be a demand for it. And I think, like, we look at the outcome of, let's take the civil rights movement, and how people really work together and, you know, the community pulled together and the institutions in the community pulled together. But it was the people that demanded these things. It was not initiated by a preacher. Even as with Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., he didn't initiate the bus boycott like many people think he did. They went, Diane Nash and the local, you know, organizers who have been organizing for years, went and found him and was like, look, we need you to, you know what I'm saying, be, you know, kind of in the forefront of this movement. So it doesn't come from whatever parts of the upper echelon. It comes from the ground, period. It comes from the ground to the point where people force these preachers to open up their churches. Or,
well, we better figure out the way. We better figure out the way.
That's what we're going to do. That's what we're doing.
Because, you know, it's not like the educational system is getting any better for our children. It's not like it's a situation to where as you, but this is how it's going. I don't know if it's like, it in Philadelphia the way it is in New York. Basically what's happening now as far as the new crop of teachers coming into New York City public schools are these Yerugals who go to these major colleges and they get caught up in so much debt that New York has the program to where as if you come work into the schools for a certain period of time, they'll pay off the percentage of your debt.
That's not totally forgiven in New York. That's nationwide.
I didn't know that. But the thing is, because I do volunteer work, and the thing is, these smart-nosed little Yerugals come in, they don't really have no knowledge or anything. They have no real interaction with the kids. The kids in our community are going through so many things, and the interaction is kind of crazy. So what happens is, but this is twofold. It's one way in the public school, and then it's another way in the charters. Because basically, as far as I observe, the charter schools get our talented kids in a lot of ways. They don't deal in New York with any of the so-called handicapped kids in charter schools. They basically weed them out, which is really against the law, if the truth be told, but they let them get away with it. So what basically happens is, in the public schools, depending on, you know, what program you get caught up into, allows that teacher to go into the public school and, you know, educate the kids. But for some reason, you can't get black college grads to come in there and do this. It's like it's beneath them in some sort of way. I don't understand it. I really, really don't. Because here it is, if you got 100 coming in, at least 90 of them are Yerugal. And they have no connection with these kids. And, you know, from what I've observed, out of the 90, you got maybe 10%, if that many, that's at least a little bit culturally sensitive. And the rest of them are just there buying their time, going along with the program, putting forward the BS, so that they could get their 5 years and get that, you know, get that loan or whatever, you know, made. And it's funny to me is because most of the teachers there that I've observed, they leave. But New York City or New York State has the best teacher's pension in the country because of that Jew. The Jew done set up the best. I don't know other school systems around the country, but if any of them as good as the New York City in regards to where the teachers and the union and the pension and the work rules and all of it that New York has, man, you should never leave that job. You see what I'm saying? But in the process, there's no sort of cultural curriculum in none of these schools. It's just like it's African History Month or Black History or whatever month going on now. They're not teaching these kids anything. It's basically a joke. And you cannot say anything also because then you'll get in trouble. You see what I'm saying? So I just feel, like you said, we need to go to the community. We need to use those lesson plans and these plans that you're creating to set up our own independent school system and do something, because we got to change this thing, because, you know, our children are not progressing as not only people, but damn sure not Africans, because they have no cultural reference to who and what we are, like you did coming up, you know, being exposed to the Dr. Benz or whatever, or whoever, the cultural conscious movement. You know what I mean? So, I mean, all I can say is good luck to your sister. Keep up the good work. But I know you got a hell of a job. Because the sad thing is that we got a situation at present right now, as far as I'm concerned, that is more vicious than the civil rights integration movement. Because now you got Negroes on TV every day, like the Angela Rye, the Paris Denard, and all of the rest of those so-called black pundits preaching us and leading us into more Uruguay madness. Have a good night. Mm. Hey, you too. Tony, I got to call you back maybe later because I got a good story to tell you. And Ricky, I'm yes, glad to see that the daddy allowed you to come back to work this evening.
Yeah.
Take it. Yeah, stay with us. We'll probably go into some open forum a little bit later. Go ahead, Richard.
If I wanted to pick up on Jay, it just is a part of our discussion, and Jay's brought up about New York and Brother Marcus, you know, is he in Louisiana?
Memphis.
Can speak to that, and I know other listeners that are in other parts of the country can speak to the public school system and what they're not doing. But it goes to what you were saying, Sister Stacy, and what we said earlier. This is a political issue, and as it relates to the black community. And you know, I believe in reading the education of Black Philadelphia, the social and educational history of the minority community from 1900 to 1950 by V.P. Franklin. And I think that what we're seeing now is what occurred in the transition between 1900, when they had quote unquote segregated schools. And as you said, those teachers were tied to the community to some degree, and they didn't have to have a curriculum to teach Black history, but they felt it was important for them to do this. And then the white teachers recognized that they needed to have an income, and they moved those Black teachers out, and they came in. When you look at what's happening now, what's going on is that the white teachers are there, and what's coming on is gentrification. And you know, and when you say gentrification, you're saying now, of course, these white people ain't going to be wanting to spend no money to send their children to private schools. They don't have that money. You know,
they're going to send them to the neighborhood schools.
Yeah, right. And when they and those the teachers,
schools, yeah.
right, and their teachers will already be there. So you'll see the outcome of those students will be different. And they'll demand, those parents will demand from those schools. What outcome they expect. So it is political, and it is political So I disagree with not in totality, but I think that we have to utilize all the institutional, private, public, homeschool, you know, charter. That has to be the political movement of the African-American community in relationship to education. And therefore, we would need what y'all are doing to be there in place, you know, a structure. One thing that we said at our charter school, and it goes to the teachers, there's no pedagogy. Nobody teach the pedagogy. How do you teach a black child? Teachers don't learn.
They do. It's not a black child. It's an urban child. There is a defined pedagogy. They have whole degrees in urban education.
Mm.
So, and then that begs the question. I'm sorry to cut you off.
I think
there needs to be a determination because that begs the question. Is like historically, anytime we look at we know that when we were enslaved, that it was up to us, if we did learn, we got a certain type of education from white folks, but it was up to us to teach our own children. When, during Reconstruction, when we were free, white people tried to teach, we said, thank you very much, but we got it, right? So we got HBCUs, we have the predecessor to freedom schools, different things like that. Then there have been several movements throughout our history here when black people have said it is better for us to educate ourselves, right, than for you to do it. Even Malcolm X said, and I'm paraphrasing, you know what I'm saying, basically, why would you hand your child over to the enemy to be educated? That's just unnatural. Nobody would do that. Nobody else does that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else does that, not voluntarily, right? So I think the idea of how you teach a black child, You honestly, I don't believe that can be taught.
Mm.
Because how do you teach a white child? How do you teach an Asian child? That's never been a question. But now it's a question on how you teach a black child. And so that question automatically assumes that we have to receive a certain type of education because we are not capable of learning a certain way. So there has to be something invented for us. Now, I can tell you how you teach a black child. You put black people who have their interests at heart because their interests are their own interests, and you let them teach them.
I should.
That's my opinion.
I accept that.
You know, we keep wanting to manifest this idea of this integrated society, and it's a farce. It's a farce. Now, we can all live on the same planet and things, but in terms of, you have to respect cultural differences. You have to respect the natural order of things. It's not a bad thing. We're like, hey, thank you very much, but go teach your children, we'll teach ours. That's not racist. That's not being, you know what I'm saying, combative. That's the natural order of things. And they know it because they don't allow that to happen to their children. They do not. There's this, I just read something about why white people do not integrate schools. We had to integrate the schools. They shipped us out. They didn't ship them in. If they shipped them in, they took over the whole neighborhood and the whole school.
Yeah. Which is what is taking place now.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's happening now again. And we have to begin to study history to recognize these cycles. Because
yes.
Each generation cannot start from jump and be like, oh, okay, what we're going to do is, no, this is the same thing over that happened 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yep.
Hmm.
Yep, and if we don't understand history, we'll keep repeating it.
Right. So that, yeah, the thing about how do you educate a black child, that's the whole basis for urban education.
Mm.
And their answer to how you teach a black child or urban child is to totally dumb it down. Remove it, have it, take it out of a cultural context. Right? That's how you teach a black child.
Sister Stacy, I want to thank you for your work, what you're doing, but I want to ask you a favor. Now, Sister Stacy, you said you teach high school.
Yes.
Some of your students that kind of pick up on things, that kind of bring things to the table, that starting to develop their critical thinking, I want you to funnel them, get in contact with myself or Brother Richard, so we can have them on the program. Mm-hmm. have them think of a subject that they want to talk about, and we'll kind of dialogue with them. They can have their friends listen, have their friends call, but we want some of the young people here so we can start showcasing what they're doing and their development of their critical analysis of our situation.
Okay. Definitely. You want me to hang on for a second, or?
Well, if you want to add some more to the conversation, but I think we were just about...
Oh, no, in terms of getting your contact information or...
Oh, no. You don't have to hang on for that, because, Richard, do you have...
Yeah, I get it.
Okay. No, we'll be in contact with you, but I want you... If you have some already in mind, that's great. But if
absolutely.
Oh, you
absolutely.
Do?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
Good.
I want to do a plug for the conference.
Go ahead. So, in fact, give out any information that you want to before we kind of wind things down.
Yes. Our second annual Black History Conference is this coming February 10th at Kensington Kappa. So 1901 Front Street is from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. It is free. It is free. And we're also serving you lunch and a little continental breakfast. And our theme this year is youth-driven solutions, right? So student solutions to community and educational issues. So we have, like, morning workshops, afternoon workshops. We have a closing plenary. We're going to have a conversation about the future of Black education. Dana King is our keynote speaker. So please, even if you can't come out for the whole day, come out, join us, have a conversation, participate in some workshops. Just come on out. It's Saturday, February 10th from 8 to 4 p.m. at Kensington Kappa High School.
Sister Stacey, I want to thank you for your work, and I can't wait for some of the young people to come on.
And let it be known, I'm not going to be what they call it, sugarcoating anything.
I don't think any of us did tonight. I think I got sucked in to be totally myself.
That's a good thing.
I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Have a good night.
All right.
Peace.
We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, I guess we can spend a little bit of time in open forum. What do you think, Richard?
Yeah.
Good. We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, be open phones. You can give us a call, 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
Bobby, hit me DVD in the garbage, man. Come on, knock it out, water, man.
Yeah.
Speak to him, Lord.
Somewhere, a black man's eyes wells up in the dark. Away from his peers. Away from his queen. Away from his offspring.
That's right.
Coming to a fork in the road and not realizing that he cannot stand still. Cause sometimes life isn't about right or wrong, just left or right.
Gotta keep it moving.
The stress, the pressure, the respect of your woman, the admiration of your child. Almost obsolete as the breadwinner when the flower is provided by the enemy. If your only resource is labor, or at least that's what they'll pay for.
Slavery, God.
What happens when they could get it for cheaper?
Man up.
Have we got an amnesia as to what a man is and what a man does?
Like power.
Is the possibility of death too great? Is the fear of physical confinement hindering your proper judgment?
I just got locked up last week.
See, death is a guarantee. And you might just get knocked just because.
That's word.
Now, your woman condescends, cause she just can't understand how she could get a job, but you cannot.
Gotta create our own job.
And look at the places you go, and the people you fraternize with, cause they say a lot about your character. And whether you are who you say you are.
Soldier.
White supremacy has struck a deadly blow, but our vital signs persist. When we know better, an excuse is just an excuse.
Stop talking,
and whether you fully comprehend or not,
yeah, Lord.
You're a man.
Stand up, let him know, Lord.
And manhood is your birthright.
Stand up.
It is your job to know what that entails, black man.
Stand up,
and it cannot be defined by our natural adversary.
Stand up.
For his ways are not ours. Do we allow our boys to be feminized?
Hell no.
Do we allow our girls to be masculinized?
Hell no.
Because sheep get on the defensive? Or do we muster manhood and stand firm on our principles?
Stand strong, Lord.
I leave that up to you, brother.
Casket drop.
But as you dry your face and contemplate your next move, keep in mind the devils love doubt.
Yeah.
And if you don't know how to be a man, they will show you how.
It's wartime.
Cypher! Peace.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and I want to thank us. This is Stacy Hill that joined us earlier in the program from the African-American History Collaborative here in Philadelphia, dealing with our young people here, exposing them to history of our people, exposing them to learning, critical thinking, exposing them to reading,
and visually talking about the history of our people and developing strategies to move our people forward in the young minds of our coming generations. Richard,
yes, sir.
That plays into the narrative that we've been talking about consistently on this program, that it's a need for think tanks to be developed in all mm-hmm. of these urban areas, and not just urban areas, wherever we dwell, on all levels. So we see now another example of a think tank being established.
Right.
For not only teachers that are teaching our young people, but having the young people involved themselves. So this just plays into what we've been talking about.
And you know, when they talk about the 60s and utilizing that as a period, a sister we had on before talking about the Panthers, that those study groups, think tanks were the basis, you know, of the movement that because people became grounded in their understanding of what it was necessary to do to become politicized. And that was another thing that came out of our discussion, you know, when we talk about education, that it's intimately tied to our politics. And you can't have politics unless you're being organized, being an organized people, and reflecting that. Because we, in order to push that educational, as Jay was raising, that administration, you're going to have power to do it. And if we're walking around and operating as individuals, then we're operating powerlessly, not powerfully. And that's something that this generation, those of us who are considered elders and the younger generations are definitely going to have to understand. Because other groups are operating as groups. They're not operating as individuals.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Man. Well, listen, we're in open forum. Anything that's on the some of the callers' minds, it's an opportunity to call up, a voice their opinions about things that have been going on during the week. Richard, you see 45 had his State of the Union address. I didn't see it.
Me neither. yeah. I tried to stay away. I did stay away from it. But, you know, he did what he did what he was supposed to do. You know, in trying to sell his program. What got me, though, the visuals I did see, Elliot, is I can't help myself. Them Negroes with the pinty cloth.
Well, you know what? You took it. I was getting ready to mention that. Go ahead.
I don't even know what to say, Elliot. Like, this was going to be their protest. This is their, when they get to the kente cloth, you know, that this was supposed to be their protest symbolic reference of who they are. But, you know what, Elliot? When we deal with, you know, this being Black History Month and Carter Woodson, you know, emphasizing the importance of us being a historically conscious people, the Ashanti of Ghana, which, you know, makes the real Kente cloth, right? They, you know, they were a people who, when the slave trade was going on, that they didn't want to participate. The king did not want to participate in selling off Africans to the Europeans to be exported to the New World. That was one group of people, nation, that consciously decided that they wouldn't do that. And when I seen the clip with them Negroes with their kente cloth on, and I think about, I just can't disassociate the idea that these Negroes selling us out every day. But they wearing this kente cloth. You know, like, that's their cultural badge. Shame on them. That's what I say. Shame!
You know, I wanted to kind of share their comments, or some of their comments, because I was looking at the route the other day when that... when it showed them. It says, according to this published report, and it shows a picture of them here, several of them. It says, U.S. lawmakers wore kente as the U.S. President Donald Trump's first State of the Union address to stage a silent protest against his infamous shithole comments. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus, the CBC, who sat together in the chamber and were largely unmoved by the president's account of his successful first year in office, say they wore the attire of kente cloth to present a large and unified force visually. Democrat Al Green of Texas, who spoke to the Daily Mail, said, "I'm wearing this to show my solidarity with the continent of Africa, and especially with those countries that the president deemed and defamed by indicating that they were shithole or shithouse countries. I'm wearing it to show that solidarity and let the president know that I'm disappointed in his statements and his behavior." Representative Bobby Scott tweeted the following, "Wearing kente cloth to the State of the Union with my fellow CBC members to stand in solidarity with people from you-know-what countries." Bobby Scott, President Trump. Oh, wait a minute. No. I went too far. Hold on a second. The whole idea was to show support for Africa, particularly after the president called Africa and Haiti shitholes, says Maxine Waters, an exclusive interview. "We thought it would be important for us to demonstrate our support in some way." So several of them saying they're showing support for African countries and African people by wearing cloth. You know, it goes to what you just said, Richard. Either these people are stupid or they're just that misguided. If you consider yourself a mover and shaker and a lawmaker and in politics, then you show your support to African people and to African countries by pushing legislation and being forceful in it, just like some of these other nationalities. They're not playing. They got lobby groups, just like these Jewish folks, and they make African Americans sign papers saying that they're going to support anything they shove down the pipe. They're going to support it. Well, don't wear no cloth to say that you back black people or back these countries. Do it with your legislation. Do it by saying these things and meaning what you say. Don't sit there silently and let these things go by the board and then you're going to wear some type of cloth. Come on. That's weak. That's weak, Richard.
Well, that's the basis of their power.
Come on. I mean, listen, you know, to me, to be honest, if you call yourself a political leader, and I heard Sister Stacy talking about the politics of these situations, then we need to groom some of our young people, especially while we're here and this system still exists, because the whole initiative should be to bring an evil system down. But while this system is still here and still exists, then we need to start developing the mindsets of our people to really be revolutionary to what we have to deal with here. And when I say revolutionary, I'm talking about committed to change.
Right.
So that means somebody that's a leader or consider themselves a leader or want to consider themselves a leader of black people must have a grasp of history. This is me. Must have a grasp of history. Must have a grasp of our historical experience here with Europeans. And be a total race man or race woman. I got to keep these callers on mute here. You got to, okay. Must be a total race man or race woman to know exactly what we're fighting for. Other people that don't understand that, then they just need to sit and watch some of the people that are cultivated under this mindset. But that's one of my criteria.
You have to have
a grasp of history to understand our historical experience here and understand our historical experience here with Europeans. You got to. They study our people, then it needs to be a study of them. Because some of these people here that consider themselves leaders, like I said, either they're stupid or they just don't understand Europeans and their mindset. And it might be a combination of both.
Well, they're able to get away with, you know, and it gets back to this here, the question about the community itself, because the community itself has to understand, and you heard Sister Stacy talking about the youth itself, but and them dealing even with this curriculum, that how compared to the 60s, there is no historical consciousness. You know, when they had that walkout in Philadelphia and in other places around the country, around, they were demanding, when CB, the Council for Independent Black Institutions, came into being, those people were demanding, that generation was demanding that African-centered education or a clear understanding, the historical understanding of who we are as an identity and as a strategy was paramount to our political organizing. They were clear about that. And that's what these guys, they don't even, you know, how could reparations still not have 100 signatures while they wearing their kente cloth?
That's what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Things that
I mean, it may not pass, but how could they, talking about their concern about what's going on, what somebody said about the continent, but when a piece of legislation is there, it just, who are you fooling? Well, as a collective body, you're going to show yourself as a one group, but you ain't going to show your constituency that you're one group.
And them Europeans just laughing. They're laughing at them because they know as soon as they snap their finger, the same ones will be running.
Mm. That's why it's like so important for, you know, when you talk about the think tank, the study groups, the understanding, you know, the communication network of being clear, because I have to say, I mean, they're talking about, but you ain't hear them talking about AFRICOM. That you ain't hear, if they were so concerned about the continent, you know, they haven't presented, gave any to their constituency or to the nation, an African perspective of their view of why AFRICOM shouldn't be or is needed in the dimension that it is on the continent. Why do we, America, have to have a military buildup for as a military president when 45 is saying they, you know, they create Fortress America? Now those politicians, they're there. Some of them are sitting on some of the committees that is allowing them to get the funding to develop those bases, whether they be drones or whatever. They're allowing to create the training positions. What is that in the best interest of the Africans, but more importantly, their constituents at home? How do we benefit from that?
Richard, I don't know. We got a couple of calls on hold that we'll go to. Another thing I want to mention also in reference to that, wearing the cloth. Did you see, like, a day later, some of the black ministers that Trump has under his thumb came out against some of the CBC members for wearing kente cloth?
Oh, yeah? So no, I didn't see that one.
Workers of iniquity, they're in Satan's house, and all types of stuff. Bishop, I'm going to just use their titles. That don't mean anything to me. Bishop Leon Benjamin, Mark Burns, and Daryl Scott are some of the ones that came out, you know, in reference to. And listen, just like we talked last week when we had our guest on about the historical use of some of our people, and that we need to have honest discussions about it. And then some people take it personally. When you can't take these things personally, you have to look at it in a historical perspective. It's the same thing. Now, these ministers, you have three black ministers came out against the CBC wearing this cloth. The use of black ministers to speak out against things that people were doing if whites didn't like it. That's the historical use of what they use ministers for. They taught them Christianity to keep the people in line. And they would use them to speak out against anything that they deemed as subversive or that they didn't like among the people. They would use them to discourage it. So when you see these three guys coming out saying this, this is a historic use of what whites usually use black pastors for. I mean, that's just a true fact. That's not, you know, somebody can take it personally. Oh, you're talking about my minister or this and that. It ain't about that. It's about why they're using these people and for what purpose. Just like the sister was on a minute ago, talking about history will keep repeating itself if we don't understand what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, evidently, these three, and these were no light-skinned pastors. They were dark as me and you, Richard. These three, they don't mind being used.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our people historically didn't mind being used. Because they figured that they was personally getting something out of it.
Right.
Then some of our ancestors in the past found out they were being used and wanted to correct the situation. But see, you don't find out all that if you don't have an historical analysis of what we're dealing with and critical thought and critical thinking of what has happened to our people. You can't have critical thought and critical thinking if I'm going to get offended at everything that has happened or everything that historically has happened to our people and I personally take offense to it. Then you can't have a critical analysis of what we're dealing with. Then those conversations, you just need to sit on the sideline and watch it develop. And then maybe after you hear some more and get yourself a little more under control and comfortable, then you can join those conversations because they have to be had. They have to be.
At least be able, you know, Ella, you know, I'm a advocate of this when you talk about, and I'm glad you bring it up in that context, that at least there's two historical narratives that Africans in this place, in the Western Hemisphere, and specifically in North America, could have to be willing to take ownership of. Africans who said they're willing to support the now American Empire, just like those Africans who said that they were willing to support the Roman Empire, they have to be able to enunciate that historical lineage. So there are others who support a national formation of our own, whether it be globally or locally. That's a historical. We have a historical narrative that we're developing. Both are developing a historical narrative, but what I see is people are trying to, you know, they don't want to take ownership because they become complicit in the death and destruction that the American Empire or the system of white supremacy has wreaked on the planet and the people around the world. They have to, you know, and compared to this name calling, or as you say, kind of becoming emotional around something. Because if you want a part of this, that's no problem. But don't try to hide that you want a part of it. Because if you want a part of it, you got to take a part of all of it. The destruction that is done. Oh yeah, it might some things came out of it. But the destruction that is done has, for others, has been a whole lot more than the things that came out of it in a short period of time. And you have to show your connection where others can show we've been fighting against that and this is our history, even if we're still trying to find that out, just like they are. But this thing of not knowing your own history and and then saying, well, I'm complicit on some things, but I ain't complicit on others. It can't be acceptable. It's contradictory. It don't make no sense.
Let's go.
And they're coming out for it. And if I may, just one point, because the thing that got me was the black parents that he brought up, talking about what that, how the, whatever that 13, that group.
Yeah, MS-13 or something like that, yeah.
Well, did you hear the comment that they, you know, they shouldn't have, this is those parents, and I empathize and sympathize with their loss. But here again, you got the symbolic, historical, the presence to us of black people and these black parents who's saying this man or this policy or this direction, you know, I'm in so much in alignment with, they shouldn't have been, they were insulting by wearing some kente cloth. They were disrespectful. That's what the father said. They were disrespectful.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were being used. They were sitting up there as props, basically, for the State of the Union. Mm-hmm. They were being used, similar to what to Hillary Clinton when she ran all those mothers out there talking about mothers of the movement, and didn't really care about these women, but using them as props. So we've seen the same thing being done during that State of the Union with the two black parents whose loved one was killed by, I think, one of those Mexican gangs out there.
Right.
Hell, you know, we can no longer be pawns to these folks. And the only way you don't become pawns, if you become aware of their strategies, aware of what they're doing, understanding your historical paradigm here, and understanding your historical perspective in regards to them, then you won't become used. You won't let anybody use you. Because you understand what they're doing.
Right. And when you become powerful in your own right, you negotiate your position. Even the, what they say, the damage that you may have to endure, you negotiate that from a position of power.
Let's go back to the phones here, and let's go back and bring 646 onto the open forum. Hey, bro.
Hey, President Elliott. Listen, let me ask you this. What do you expect from them Negroes anyway? Seriously.
Oh, listen. To be honest, I don't expect.
What do you really expect? You know, that's no different, honestly, in all truthfulness, than Trump calling that African country in Haiti a shithole country, them disrespecting the culture in that manner, when them Negroes there ain't got no love for African people. They go along doing some of the most treacherous things to the continent and to Haiti without putting up no type of fight back whatsoever. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, sometimes we need to call people out who really play games with us. And that's all they do is they just play games with us. You know, most of those Negroes that's in the Congress have became very, I would say, well-off Negroes.
Yeah.
And their communities haven't improved from the time their black ass has been in office. If the truth be told, you know, in all honesty, all of those Negroes there are doing quite well. Ain't none of them Negroes there not doing better than me and you. You see what I'm saying? And we always want to make it out that they're some sort of leader. It's just like that whole dog and pony show that happened Wednesday night on BET. To the rebuttal of, you know, the orange weevil. None of them came from an African perspective. Every
everything that they came from was trying to get you closer to the daddy. That's all. Incorporating your existence on the planet to making that goddamn Urugu happy.
Mm.
And keeping them from putting his foot in your behind. That's all. Nothing more, nothing less. In all truthfulness, nothing more, nothing less. They have no plan or no agenda, just like the Democratic Party has no plan or no agenda for African people. The only thing that the Democratic Party wants to do is figure out how to get that Urugu, no good, filthy, stinking white man back in their midst. That's all. They like, you know what the Democratic Party is like? A woman who loses a man but wants her back because the sex is great. That's all. That's all. That's what it is. They can't get over the sex. When the sex is good, they can't get over it. They think about it. They dream about it. They want it all the time. And that's what the Democratic Party is in regards to how they respond to white men. And the reality is, the next woman may not think it's that good.
Mm.
you see what I'm saying? And in the process, we constantly want to give it away. And what next is a report and return. Just come through me. You know what I mean? I don't want no orgasm. I don't want no pleasure. I don't want nothing. I just want to be screwed. And that's what they do. They screw over us. And in the process, we get nothing. Just like your last guest was on there. And think about it. All that time that y'all was on the phone discussing our situation, the bottom line in all of it is we still under the control of the Urugu. Trying to figure out how we can get out of his control and set up our own thing, but not really wanting to break away from his thing, because what does he do? He keep a paycheck in our pocket. You know what I mean? He keep our children's parents under the illusion that he's going to educate them and give them a chance in this society. When, in all honesty, the chances are dwindling. You can look at the whole immigration thing that's going on to show you how wicked they are and how they have to figure out how to put this Urugu back in a position of thinking that he has something. The majority of the people that they're sending back to their native country are people that provide more to this society than most Urugus do. They just sent the man back to India or some damn where that was a business owner, that employed people, that was paying more money in taxes than the average Urugu pays when he works. But they're going to get rid of him because now they got to figure out how they're going to get this Urugu to what you call him, fill his position in society. When it's not going to happen. Because, listen, I'm going to make this prediction. If this thing keep on going on with the Baba Louis and the rest of them, food prices are going to go up by at least 10% next year. Mm-hmm. Who's going to pick the fruit? Nobody is talking about what's happening in Florida and California in regards to picking of fruits and vegetables. Nobody's talking about it. They had a hard time getting people to pick fruits and vegetables this year. So there's so many things going on that we don't even know about because they keep us thinking about Donald Trump and the Russian investigation. But here it is. I'm looking on Twitter, and I'm seeing that old Ben Carson and his family is stealing from HUD, doing deals, to get paid while he's dead or hard.
Well, listen.
And here it is, they trying to cut all types of services that they can in regards to HUD. It's absolutely unbelievable.
Well,
but they go get him, though.
He's only doing what these other politicians do. But, but being that he's black, and if he's doing that, he'll get nailed.
Oh, they go get him. They go nail him. They go nail him. Because there always got to be a face of corruption and the type of things that he's doing, and it always got to be a black face. But Negroes don't realize that. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm kind of surprised, and then I'm not surprised, because you know who's, what you call them, biggest advisor is. Ben Carson. Do you know who that is?
His advisor.
Yeah. His biggest advisor.
No.
Armstrong Williams.
Oh, okay.
Armstrong Williams is his money man.
Birds of a feather.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying? And you know, back in the day, Armstrong Williams got caught for $250,000, you know, doing his thing, pushing forward that Republican agenda in the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? But now let's be clear on something. Armstrong Williams has been rewarded pretty good, because I think he's the second biggest media owner in Black America, other than Cassie Hughes, the truth be told, from what I understand.
Yeah, he's trying to acquire.
You see what I'm saying? That's deep. And from my understanding, he's deep in the pockets with, I think it's Clear Channel or Sinclair, or one of those media conglomerates that basically have control of everything. He's like their black minority face. So whenever they got to sell something to the minority, he's the first Negro that gets the call, and they even help him finance it.
Yeah.
So these are some real, real dangerous people.
And then he'll put out a narrative that they want other black folks to follow.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just like that whole thing. You never hear nobody on any of these shows trying to deal from an opposite African perspective. You know, it's just like Terrestrial Radio. The only black show host that I know of on Terrestrial Radio that really deals in anything black is Carl Nelson. He's the only one that will have an African scholar on this show. Other than that, man, you ain't got nothing going on. And you know, it's also been funny. I don't know if you've seen it. This whole thing going on with Yvette Carnell and Boyce Watson. I call it black on black crime. A homosexual is a fraud, a liar, and a thief. And, you know, come on. Boyce Watkins, you can't trust that Negro. You know, and she exposing him. So now she want to pull out her gay card on her, and that she got her a Urugu girlfriend. Everybody knows she gay. Who the hell cares? Do you expect the light-skinned chick like that, who's basically ugly and bad-looking, to not have
her,
you Google woman?
Nah, here we go. Yeah, come on.
Jay, only you can do that.
Hey, Jay, listen.
I gotta call it like I said. I'll take the hit for it.
Well,
I'm saying, we gotta honestly get to the point to where we don't even pay these people any mind.
Jay,
because they're not doing anything.
Jay, before I let you go, I want you to give us a report Sunday on what?
On what?
On what happens at the... you know, at the
Super Bowl?
No, ain't no Super Bowl. We want you to give us a report of what happens when you go see the pastor on Sunday.
No. But let me make
you know you're going to see Pastor Manning, and you're
going to
put money in the tray.
I'm not going to see the Black Panther. I'm boycotting the Black Panther. And I'm going to tell you
the Black Panther? I didn't say nothing about no Black Panther. You didn't hear what I said. You didn't hear what I said. I ain't said nothing about no Black Panther.
What Panther?
Panda. I said when you go see Pastor Manning, give us a report.
Give us a report on what happens and let us know how much you put in that basket.
You know you're going to put money in that basket.
Nah, man, I don't get no pork chop in your mother. I'm trying to take money out the basket and get my hand.
You're going to get arrested.
Cut your hand off and give your business up in that church talking about you stealing the Lord's money. You know how many times I've sat in a church and looked at that money and shook my head and say, you know, if I was really the sinner that they claim me to be, I would take that money. But no, let me leave you with this. I'm boycotting the Black Panther.
Now you're stepping on my toe, Joe.
I'm going to tell you why right quick, Richard. The reason why I'm boycotting it is I'm sick of seeing the black man being led by the Jerugu, man.
I understand.
There is not there is not any comic book supposed superhero or anything that is not being overseen by the UN. Now, here it is. You got a black movie that I think is something like 98% casted
nice.
With blacks. But the man that's leading them is a Yoruba. I can't do it no more, man.
Yes.
I can't do it no more. What? And that's everyone. That's Blade. That's this new Black Lightning. That's whatever black superhero there's been. There's always been that Yoruba as his guidance for us and his enlightenment. Now, you know, seriously, at some point in time, you got to really put your foot down on it. But I know I'm in the minority on this, and I understand it, I accept it, it's no problem. But no, what I'm going to do in my protest is, I'm going to spend the money that I would spend on the movie, and I'm going to buy a book for my niece or nephew. And
okay.
I think that'll be just desserts. And my commitment. And then, you know, when the chinky chinks to come around with a bootleg good copy, 3 weeks later, I may get one.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You may get one.
And on,
yeah,
that
okay.
note, and on that note, Richard, I'm glad that you back. I met you last Sunday. You know what yeah. I mean? Elliot had to do a human's job all by himself without his sidekick. But he did a damn good job. So listen, that should tell you. Let's just tell you, Richard, stop working for the daddy and come on home. Because you may be out. You may have to find somebody else because you want to work for the daddy and not for him. Have a good day, brother.
Let's go to 215. 215. 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing, man?
Hey, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing very, Brother Rich. How you doing, my brother?
All right, man. How you feeling?
I'm going to find out. Praises be to Allah.
Well, listen, you know, Joe, before you get started, yeah. I know you're in mourning. So, you know, I am? Yeah. You're in mourning and you're in, your spirits are low.
You talking about because of the congressman?
you say Brady is not coming back?
Uncle Bobby. And I'm not talking about Uncle Bobby's cafe either. Uncle Bobby.
Wait a minute. Wow. Since you brought that up, Elliot, and I apologize, Joe, but isn't it still masterful what he did?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
In 2011, he got redistricting where his district will have a predominantly white population.
Right.
And this is 2018. And he got those black state legislators to agree with him.
Agree with it.
And then he walks off.
See, it just goes back, Brother Richard, what Brother Jay was saying just now. You know, see, these Negroes and stuff, they ain't worth nothing. Like what Jay said, these Negroes are well off. And if Jay's still listening, which I'm sure he is, he had to be honest. I say that almost every show, every other show. I say these Negroes, all they worry about is a paycheck. They could give a damn. I'm talking on the city level, the state level, and the federal level. Them Negroes could give a damn about the plight of black people. They could give a damn that our children in Flint, Michigan, drinking bad water. Or they could care less about our children sitting up in Baltimore, Maryland, in cold classrooms that we pay taxes less like white folks pay. And we law-abiding, like I guess like some of them devils is. I mean, I know that there's some of them that's law-abiding. But the point I'm saying, we pay the same taxes and stuff, but yet our children sit up in cold classrooms, and these Negroes sit up there on the city, state, and federal level, know this stuff is going on, and they don't do a damn, because all they worry about is the quote Brother Jay, getting close to the daddy. That's all they worried about. Them Negroes, they all they worried about is a paycheck. And like you even said yourself, Brother Ali, some of them wear kente cloth. You and Richard alluded to that, but yeah, they'll sit there and sign legislation supporting Afrikaan, supporting Jones being flown on our people, and that's why it's going to bring you in conflict with them Negroes, because when you have to deal with Afrikaan, then that means they have to criticize Barack Obama. See what I'm saying? See, that's the connection, since he was the founder or one of the instigators of Afrikaan. So them Negroes don't want to, even though Obama not in office no more, they don't want to be in direct conflict with the former fraud president. So they're not going to even deal with that either. So they're going to tap dance around that. The only one that would deal with it is somebody like a Cedric Richmond or even Maxine Waters to a large degree, and the sister Cynthia McKinney if she was still in office. But the mother Negro's not going to, I mean, Brother Al Green even would deal with it. But the mother Negro's not going to deal with it because, again, it would bring them in direct conflict with Barack Obama's legacy. See what I'm saying? So you're dealing with that pyramid of things right there. See, and like I say, as long as we keep on voting for these Negroes, Elliot and Richard, on the city, state, and federal level, we're going to keep getting what we're getting because, as to quote Einstein, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. It's like me banging my head against a brick wall and wonder each time why I do it, my head get busted open. It's going to continue to happen until I stop doing it. If I say I'm going to kill myself first, you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know why we keep continue to expect something to change. If you notice, Ellie and Richard, and remember, Ellie, when I dropped that packet off to your shop the other week?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was Barack Obama and Biden and Mitt Romney. Now, they federal employees, but federal politicians. But the point I'm saying, even on the local level, we got these niggas right here on city council, that's phony president of city council, Dale Clark. I'm going to say him just by name. This phony Negro, like I said, it wasn't for Asa Khalif and brother Ike Ross, he would have never talked about David Jones getting murdered by that devil cop. He was not going to bring that up. It wasn't for them embarrassing him. And see, again, this man has joined forces in the past with a racist bigot like Pat Toomey. See, these niggas, they do all they can to sell our people out on any level and let the record show for Dale Clark. And again, I'm not against nobody being wealthy or trying to make money for it. But see, them niggas, they get wealthy not for helping black people. They get, wealthy a lot of times of selling black people out, mm-hmm. L.A. Richard, you know what I mean? They do it at the expense of black people. Dale Clark is wealthy. He got properties over in Cherry Hill, New Jersey right now. They say it's wildly been circulated. He has a big home, $500,000 home in Cherry Hill that he stays there from time to time because, you know, the city lacks their laws. Now, you don't have to necessarily live in the city no more to be a city employee. You know, whether it's a police officer, fireman, whatever the case may be, city council, you can actually live outside the city. Now, in other words, you can live in Jersey and still be a fucking city council person. See what I'm saying?
Okay.
So, you understand what I'm saying, Richard Nelly?
Yeah. As long as you have a residence in the district that you
exactly. So I mean, so these Negroes, they independently wealthy. Like Jay correctly said, these Negroes are wealthy and stuff. Whether they're on the city, state, and federal level, even that idiot that just went to jail, Shaka Fatah, he had a net worth of $2 million and stuff like that. Why he was doing the dumb stuff he was doing when he already was wealthy and stuff. But again, they think they can do what the cracker do, and that's why they wind up getting nailed. But the point is that these people ain't thinking about us and stuff, man. Like Jay said, they more wealthy than any of us three combined. So you only got very few on a city, state, or federal level in a political arena that really care about the plight of black. You can probably count them on one hand and probably wouldn't have to use all the fingers on that one hand. Them niggas ain't already worried about closing up the white people, being a rubber stamp for Israel, you know, protecting. And this is the key, and this is something that you can't gloss over, Ellie and Richard. Their whole thing, whether on a city, state, or federal level, their whole thing is protecting Barack Obama's legacy. He's our first black president, child. You know, that's the first thing them niggas going to holler. They want to protect his legacy no matter how rotten he was when it comes to helping kill Gaddafi or Afrikaner. They want to protect his legacy so you're going to run into a fight with them on that and stuff. And they want to close up the white people. And like I say, they want to prove a white people. They want to, like I say, they want to be a rubber stamp for Israel. See, this is what Honorable Elijah Muhammad said years ago. He said that's why he respected Adam Clayton Powell. And he kept it simple. The messenger kept it simple. He said he's not support Adam Clayton Powell, though he's a Christian minister. He said not because of his Christianity or whatever. I support him because he's not afraid of the white man. He made it plain and simple. He said Adam Clayton Powell is not afraid of white people. And too many of these Negroes that we deemed leaders, not you and me, Elliot or Richard or Jay, I'm talking about but some of people that don't know no better, they put that title lead on these Negroes, and they don't deserve that title because these Negroes are scared to death of white people. They are scared to death of these people and stuff like that. When you play that clip, Brother Elliot, of Dave Richardson, that's a man. That's why I say on Dave's Richardson's tombstone, all you got to put on there is here lies a man. Because Dave was a man. He was the only, and I know this from a fact because I was dead. Nobody can tell me. I lived it, my brother. They was the only black politician in this damn city of Philadelphia. When the Honorable Minister Furcon was speaking in Philadelphia, he was the only one that would stand on the dais with the minister. Dwight Evans, all them Negroes, they ran like they saw a Casper the Friendly Ghost. That's right. They ran as far from Furcon. You thought Furcon smelled like a skunk the way they ran from that brother. You know what I mean? But Dave would sit up there with the minister, right on the dais with the minister. Because Dave's attitude, and you heard what he said on the clip you play, Ellie, he said, I was a black man first. Way before I became a politician or a state rep, I'm a black man. You know what I mean? They stood up like a man. That's why Dave's physically gone, but Dave's fighting warrior spirit will always be with us because he was a man. Cynthia McKinney, though she's not in office no more and stuff, she's a strong black sister because she stand up for what's right. You know what I mean? She's speaking stronger. She's speaking stronger now. She ever did. I mean, she spoke strong when she was in office, but she's still, even though she's not in office, but she's still letting our people know that she loves our people and she supports our people. You find very few people like a Seth McKinney or a Dave Richardson, you know what I mean? Because them niggas are far and few between. And until we come to that realization, Ellie and Richard, about the lack of black leadership that we got on the city, state, and federal level, even the religious community, we're going to continue to get what we get. Them, like you said, Ellie, them flunkies that you saw stuff there with Trump and stuff, they, again, they willing participants. It don't matter whether they dark-skinned, light-skinned, or whatever. They are Negroes, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They want to be used, you know?
Yeah.
They want to be used. They don't matter. They could be light-skinned. They could be light as the light outside or dark as the dark of night. It doesn't matter. Them Negroes got a white man's mindset and stuff, and they don't mind the white man kicking up their behind. Lord, they're getting a few dollars. Them Negroes, Ellie and Richard, they'll sell their own mother down the drain. They don't give a damn. You know what I mean? They're some sellout traitors, Negroes, and it's going to come to a point, Ellie and Richard, and y'all discussed it a little bit last week, it's going to have to come to a point when you mentioned something, when we got to deal with these traitors in our community, whether it's the religious traitors or the black politician traitors or whatever. We cannot continue to progress as a people. Some traitors going to have to be dealt with in one form or another. I'm not advocating anything. I'm just putting it out there in the universe. But somehow, the Negroes going to have to be dealt with, whether they're male or female. They're going to have to be dealt with because they are hurting our people and stuff, man. Them Negroes that they're running around with Trump and them bigots and the Democrat and Republican Party selling our people down the drain, they got to be at the very least until we get the full state of what we have to do. They at the very least have to be ostracized from the black community. That's the least we can do. And that's an interim, of course, before we get the just punishment that they really deserve. But in the interim, them Negroes definitely need to be ostracized out the black community because they do too much harm to our people, man. Way too much harm. I mean, you know, like you said, and again, I'm no fan of some of them Negroes with the kente cloth, but how dare you sit there and jump on a sister or brother because they wearing kente cloth? I mean, give me a break. But see, again, that's that winning the approval of white people, like that same them Negroes that came out with that old racist skank, Elliot, Ann Coulter, she came on to attack Dr. Kuringa, remember? Kwanzaa. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They send them handkerchief of Negroes out right out there to join in. They trash the Kwanzaa, trash Dr. Kuringa and stuff like that. Anything black, them devils want to downgrade. And they always get their stool pigeon Negroes to be willing to participants and stuff. And again, it's Negroes like that. We got at the very least, like I said, Ellie and Richard, ostracize those Negroes. Run them out of the community. And I'll close with this, Ellie and Richard, on that a fat congressman who just resigned the other day. Now, again, black folks are some of the gullible people. You'll have Negroes on terrestrial radio, Ellie. You know what I'm talking about. They'll be on there tomorrow, and I guess with the week coming, because it just happened, they've been so digested with this Eagle stuff. But when all the Eagle news died down, whether them bums win or lose Sunday, you'll start getting back to some kind of reality. So when the fat Irishman talk about his legacy, that you had Negroes saying, well, yeah, I can understand. Well, you know, he want to spend more time with his grandchildren, his great-grands, and all that foolishness. They'll buy the company line. Now, like I said, Alex, he had no problem for the last 10, 5, 10, 15 years missing his grandchildren's birthdays and great-grandchildren. He had no problem missing it. Do you find it coincidental, Richard Ellis, or maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist? Do you find it ironic that now he wants to spend time with him because he was under federal indictment probe?
Yeah. That's what I was now, thinking.
You know, also he wants to spend more time with the grands all of a sudden now. But see, again, Brother Richard and Ellen, we know how the game is played. It's all about white racism, white supremacy, whatever term you want to describe to it. He was, and I talked to a well-known Philly lawyer in this town, and he said, and I'm not going to sugarcoat, he'll mind me saying his name, Leon Williams, and Leon said it best. Leon said, Brother Joe, you know what the deal is. He said, the feds went to him. They gave him a sweetheart deal, which they wouldn't give to a black. They could have gave the same deal to Shaka. They probably went to Brady and said, look, man, If you just go ahead and resign, don't run for re-election, we won't press charge against you. That we'll save your pension and everything. They could have gave the same deal to Shaka, but see, Shaka's a black man. And this is what Brother Richard was just, I mean, Brother Jay was saying a few minutes ago. See, Negroes don't learn. They don't understand how the white man, how he deals with them. He don't have no respect for them. See, they'll give a white man a sweetheart deal like that, but you're a black man, they'll throw your black behind in jail. Shaka found out the hard way. And to show you, I got precedent, Ellen Richard, you know what I'm talking about. It's a white governor, Republican former governor of, I think it's South Carolina. Virginia, I'm sorry. Forgot the white boy's name was Robert. Not just him, but his wife. Did the same exact thing Shaka Fatai did. Matter of fact, did even worse things. Got convicted, right? The United States Supreme Court, no less. This is a fact, Ellie. You think I'm lying? Check it out, brother. They said that the prosecutors overreached. They went way beyond and stuff, and he got the Supreme, I think he got like 7, 8, 9 years in jail, was convicted. The racist U.S. Supreme Court overturned his conviction, said the federal prosecutors overreached. Now, they overreached for this white boy, but they didn't overreach in Shaka's case, though. So Shaka's sitting in jail doing 10 years with a white Republican governor, did the same thing and worse, but he's walking free as a bird now. You know what I'm saying? And then, like you say, with Melendez over in Jersey, he's a Latino, but see, they know it looks bad to go after him. That's why they dropped charge against him, because for two reasons, L.A. Richard Fraser, he's a rubber stamp for Israel, number one. Number two, you know, with all this doctor stuff going to Dreamers, they didn't want to look racist going after him, so he getting a pass. And you saw he's such a rubber stamp for Israel, because remember, don't forget, yeah, Lindsey Graham and Orrin Hatch, two conservative Republican senators, came and testified at this trial. You remember Ellen Richard?
Whenever
you ever seen them guys do something like that for a guy? Because you know why? They know he's a rubber stamp for Israel.
Oh, wait a minute. And he's a Democrat.
And he's an exactly. Like, don't let that slide by. He's a Democrat. That's right, because they know they can count on him, because they're all about this white evangelical Christianity. So they know a guy like Menendez is always going to be a rubber stamp for Israel. So that's why he gets the pass. And you see right here, Ellen, when all people will learn, Ellen Richard, right here in Philadelphia, sitting on a local level, Vince Fumo, the racist former bigoted state senator, did all kinds of stuff. Got 5 years in jail. He cried the blues. Got 5 years in federal prison. He only did like 3. Brother Corey Kemp, the former city treasurer on the John Street, he just got out of jail just the other year. He did 10 years in jail, and all he did, Brother Ellen Richard, was get Super Bowl tickets and a deck on his house. And he got 10 years in jail, whereas Vince Fumo did all that robbing and stealing. Here this man was already a multimillionaire, did all that robbing and stealing and corruption. He gets 5 years. He cried the blues so much that he cut to 3.5 years. But Corey Kemp did 10 years in jail for a deck. I'm going to say it again, for a damn deck on his house and Super Bowl tickets. And see, they was mad with him because he didn't want to wear a wire to go after, because they wouldn't believe on the John Street. But see, he was the convenient patsy, so since he didn't want to play ball with the feds, that's why they went and stand him 10 years on him. But at the end of the day, his only crime, basically, I'm going to say it again, was getting Super Bowl tickets to the Super Bowl, I think some Sixers tickets, and a deck built on his house. And so for that, he did 10 years in federal prison. With Vince Fumo, did all kinds of stuff. He gets 3.5 years. So again, these Negroes don't learn. And Fat Boy Brady, the same way. They could have, like I said, they could have gave Shaka the same kind of deal. But they said, hell with this nigga. We don't care nothing about him. He threw his behind in jail. And now he threw Shaka in jail, threw his son in jail. And to show you how people are so dumb, Ellen Richard, Shaka and his son both got convicted they both got sent to jail by the same judge. Now I'm saying to myself, if Shaka had any damn sense or his lawyers, they would have said, look, I don't want my client tried by the same judge that sent my son to jail. If that ain't a conflict, then you don't know what is. How you going to have any kind of objectivity when you sent the man's son to jail for 5 years first, then you come back several months later and send the father to jail for 10 years? You know what I mean? But again, these Negroes are dumb. They don't understand what the white man's mentality and what they're dealing with, so they're going to continue to get kicked up their behind and stuff, man. You know what I mean? They don't understand what they're dealing with. So you have Negroes going to buy that nonsense that Brady's saying about spending time with his family and stuff like that. Brady got a sweetheart deal. He can sit back, get his pension, shot Tucker got convicted, he loses his pension, but Fat Boy Brady better keep his, and he'll live a life of luxury, and you have Negroes kissing his ring over the next month saying how great he was for black people, even though he had one of the poorest districts in the United States, but they'll be kissing his ring, praying this fat white behind saying how great he is. I mean, we just, like I said, boy, we just are glutton for punishment sometimes. I'm telling you, man, we as a people sometimes are a glutton for punishment. I mean, what did this white man have to do sometime, Ellen Richard, to our people if we wake up and smell the coffee, man? I just wonder sometimes. I really do.
Yeah, and, you know? And you'll also see him lining up now to see who's going to get that seat.
And that's the thing, brother Elliot. They wouldn't run against Brady. You can get them niggas to run against Brady, but yet that Brady's out of race. Now they want to run against each other now. You know what I mean? If Brady was so slimy, he would pay some of these niggas to get in the race to make sure a viable black, and this is the word I'm using, Elliot, a viable black candidate and run against them. He did all kinds of slimy
and listen,
stuff.
And listen, he had been doing that practice for years.
He did it
with a terrestrial host that's on the radio now. In
that's right. That's right.
Paid
he's
him.
A mouthpiece. He's a mouthpiece for Brady, a mouthpiece.
Paid him to get out of the race. You remember when he was planning to run that time?
Oh, yeah, he paid him off as well. I mean, with chicken and sugar coat, he paid him off as well. So that's why he dropped out of the race, and they gave his son a job on the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission. You know what I mean? See again, all these Negroes look out for each other. Again, they go back to what Jay was saying. All these Negroes worry about is enriching themselves at the expense of the black community. That's why it's no accident that you got Jesse Jackson and Sharpton. Neither one of them ever don't own a church, and yet both are multimillionaires. Because that's from years of selling black people down the drain. But see, they just like Barashago say, they just do enough to think that they are with you. But like Dr. Barashago said, they do just enough to think they are with you, but they are not. You know what I mean? See, Sharp is smart and wise. He know when certain issues come up. And to his credit, he do bring them to the attention of our people with high-profile shootings like Trayvon Martin or Sandra Bland or Gardner up in, Brother Ed Gardner of New York. Sharpton right on the case, so he brings it to our people's attention because it definitely need to be dealt with. But at the end of the day, and stuff, Sharpton still, you know, he ever knows what, like I said, with Sharpton, he'll never say nothing about Israel because he knows he cannot afford to offend his Zionist backers. So Sharpton just said enough for black people to think that he was, but he's really not. He, at the end of the day, he's going to stay in line. Same with Jesse. He's going to stay in line because he remember Jesse, just like Sharpton, he get that Rainbow Wall Street Project. These are big, rich white Jews and white other white people that got millions of money. So Jesse ain't going to save us so much because he don't want to get lose that financial backing. They got these niggas under control, man. They got them under their thumb. You know what I mean? It's a no accident, again, why Jesse's rich, Sharpton's rich, and some of these other Negroes and stuff. They get rich at the expense of their own people, and they pretty much number black pimps and prostitutes. They're getting rich off black people's misery. But again, Ellen, we got to blame ourselves, Brother Ellen Richard, because we keep on, not you and me and Richard individually, but we keep on as a people, as a man mask, keep putting these same Negroes in office. Like I said, the definition of insanity is to keep hitting your head up against the wall and expect a different result. You know, it's that simple, man.
Joe, thank you for your call, man.
Thanks, Brother Ellen. Thank you, Brother Richard.
All right, now.
Peace. Richard, we come up on the end of another program.
Yes.
One thing I want to mention, I don't know whether you caught Let's Buy Black 365.com Connect. Been streaming on the site on Monday nights. They got a good program. And there's, you know, that technology, you know, I was kind of leery of how it was going to work out. But it seems to work out great, man.
Great, great. I haven't been able to catch it yet.
And I was just down there with Brother Jihad the other night, looking at his place down there, down a couple blocks from you, Richard.
Right.
Yeah, you got the yoga studio. And in the back, it's going to be where he's going to do a lot of his broadcasting with his program. Yoga studio's in the front. So I told him, I said, Richard will bring his mat down here and get down on the floor. Yeah, but...
okay.
Yeah, he said he got about room in there for 20 people.
Oh, okay.
In fact, it's right down, right on the corner of
22nd. I've seen him when I catch the bus there.
Yeah, well, he's supposed to be ready on Monday. I don't know I'm going to do all I can to get him ready. But he's supposed to be ready for his program on Monday night. And he'll come on before Let's Buy Black365.com Connect. He'll come on from 6 to 8. And he's planning to do the same thing, stream his program with live audio and video.
Great.
So we'll see how that works out. If he's not ready this Monday, now he's been putting out on social media that he'll be ready Monday. So I'm going to do all I can to make sure that that happens. But new program starting next, and hopefully we'll have Brother Paul from over there in the UK be ready sometime this month. No date nailed down for that yet.
Great.
But his program, Connecting the Dots UK, will be debuting sometime this month. We're still working on that. But tomorrow is SST with Troy Wilmore, Saturday Sports Talk. That'll be on tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 12 noon. So catch Brother Troy, call him up, hit him with a barrage of questions. It's an interesting program, SST, with Troy Wilmore. And it's Saturday morning at 10 o'clock on Time for an Awakening. Come up on the end of another program, Brother Richard. I want to thank the listening audience for participating in the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they're soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. To play such a small part of the things that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a farmer. Oh.
save the children. Soon it will be their chance to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.